up. It seems like every year, every conference, I get stuck with the opening announcement. The guy who usually goes to bed at 8 o'clock in the morning, so great to see you here. You know, I coded in Lisp for 12 years. A couple of years working on the AI, maybe 10 years producing all sorts of things like breakpoint, barf, call John L, compiler messages. We have no place to publish a paper on Lisp. I never wrote anything, never published a paper. Well, yeah, somebody mentioned my name's on an AI lab memo, but I don't remember them. And then finally, I heard of this great idea. Somebody who worked with McCarthy was going for a Lisp conference at Stanford in Memorial Hall, August 1980. So we went. We all had these papers, and they all got accepted, and they were all seminal papers of Lisp. They were. The 1980 Lisp conference reproduced again by Sigplan some years later. And then Sigplan took up a series of Lisp programming conferences. How do we have a conference then? How has it been 25 years since we've had a Lisp conference at Stanford? The first conference was brought to us by John Allen. He is our first speaker this morning. He's going to give us a little bit of history, a lot of mystery, and the ballast is what holds the tank down. So let's give our attention to John Allen.
File cabinet that I ran into about 1964, this gratuitous palm tree up there in the top, that was put in by John Johnson, a friend of ours. Let's see where if this works. History, mystery, and ballast. There's going to be a few of these obnoxious things at the beginning here. Three doors for file cabinet by Steve Russell. The first conference actually was in 1964 in Mexico City. John will call it ours the seminal conference, but I think that's the attraction of the Florida Indians, so we weren't seminal in that sense. We turned into, as I say, the bunk list. You can't see my camera. Lisp and Functional Programming Conference picked us up the next year and finally figured out that it was time to quit about 1996. I'm going to call this thing a hovercraft lecture. It's based on a quote by Dana Scott. I can't remember where he stole it. But the idea of a hovercraft lecture, as it says here, is skimming over the surface at very high speed. Because I don't read papers, so I want to talk about what's going on behind the scenes on this thing. So the talk is really going to cover the music. But not the words. But sometimes the words are music, and this is the music and words that got this thing going. You can read this, probably have read it before, but it really sets up the point. It's about 1963-64, that the right attitude is just half of the about. But the title of the talk is not going to be history, mystery, and ballast. It's going to be more ballast. This again is a picture of me when I had a different distribution of hair. It's called more ballast because the paper started out supposed to be in 10 pages. By the time I got it to John, it was 12 pages in the ACM format, which he said okay. But then I found out that ACM template had been set up for 9-point font. He wanted 10-point font, so I changed it to 10-point font, and lo and behold, about 2 more pages. There was a certain amount of grumbling, good-natured and appropriate grumbling, about 14 pages, but after a while, the reviewer came back and said, he needs more ballast. So that was good news and the bad news. But that reminded me of a story about Neil Young that Graham Nash told. And this is the story, which is also on the back of this shirt. This is the More Barn t-shirt. you can read my shirt later, but I'll put them on here. But that, anyway, this all sort of went together. There's also a broken arrow in the back, too, which is the name of the new brand. So, the ballast here is really about the course that we teach at Santa Clara, which for lack of a better name, we're calling the more ballast course. Like anatomy, which was done a long time ago, it's not research, but it's sort of motivation. It's, I guess, trying to get the spirit right to fulfill the quote that Dorothy put together some 40-plus years ago, when I was only four. We have a different situation at Santa Clara. We have engineers, not computer science people, as Alan Kay is talking about, but the attitude is the same, that we're fighting this notion of vocational training as what computation is about. We have a double bind down there because the engineers are also graduate engineers, not undergraduates. And as I say here, graduate engineers are averse to theory. The course started at Santa Clara, under the name of PDC, or Truth Deduction and Computation, in 1980. We turned into a book that was published in 89. In the paper, I mistyped, and I said the reference there is just said 1979. I should remember 1989 because the party for the publishing of the book was 2 days before the Loma Prieta earthquake. So we spent it we cleaned up for the party. We didn't clean up the house because we slept in a tent in the backyard for 3 days. I think there is no correspondence between the publishing and the book and the earth. The early version of the course, this basically 1980 to 1998, covered three languages with three different perspectives. Basically, propositional predicate calculus and the type 3 lambda calculus. As the languages, we did truth deduction and computation, which is something to say constipation. The calculus was done courtesy of the Hilbert axioms, which was sort of a inhuman way of looking at the axiomization of logic. The truth was the typical kind of stuff, because this is classically posed as truth tables in Paul and Tarski semantics. Computation in the predicate case, in the proposition predicate case, was done by ground resolution and general resolution. When we got to the lambda calculus, we did Scott models, the original models of him, his, her, whatever. The thing that I remember from that period was this incredible disconnect in the class between what they do as programmers and what they see as basically substitution and simplification as the underlying model, and this idea of reduction as compared to evaluation. It didn't make the connection between the structure of the theoretical view of what evaluation was and what they actually did in the program. That is always disturbing. I went away to be a house husband t-shirt. T-shirts are good. This, when I came back to the second incarnation of this course, I had to build a t-shirt. Since this was Cohen 260, I go back to the slides of the damn nostrils on the way. So the Cohen 260 thing, I figured they aren't going to listen to me. We just watched the 33 pictures of the t-shirt. So again, I'll point to my picture. That's me there with more hair. That's Ruth with the same amount of hair. This can of whipped cream in her hand. We won't talk about that. There's a lot going on there, some of which is not repeatable. The remodel course, as I say, I went off to be a house husband for about 10 years and came back to computation because I thought things might have gotten better. In fact, as far as I can see, they got worse. I think that's probably what Alan Kay was talking about, too. But anyway, we started remodeling the course. Now, the course, let's say, 98 plus, because this is a work in progress. These are things that we've done and things that we are doing. So it's just the general flow of where we're trying to go with the thing. It was the same three languages. It was the same basic attitudes towards the language, and that is the truth, deduction, and computation. The structure of how one uses the formalism, the calculus, had changed. So Jensen rules, the natural deduction and sequence style, was much more appropriate dealing with
taking logic ideas into the realm of practical computation. Oh, that's going to carry over down here to the Kurt Howard stuff at the bottom. In terms of the semantics, I was trying to move from the truth table and the Parsky-like arguments with domains as their underlying features into this notion of algebraic semantics. So don't have to worry about specifics. So the Boolean Heighting cylinders and lambda algebra is what we're after for talking about the truth component of this stuff. As I said, the deduction part is a shift from Hilbert to Gensen and conventional deduction style stuff. Trying to get the attention of the engineers again, since Tycho Lembeka, this isn't quite their forte, I decided they would try to back into it through a version of Steam. This is the M script, which is just not playing it. I'll see my finger. Blackboard Steam and what I call Blackboard ML, the salient characteristics of those things are that we started with an M expression rather than an S expression version of the lists on Steam, and explicit typing, because types are going to be a critical part of this picture with the Blackboard ML. The thing which holds it together is this notion of Curry Howard, which I'll talk about as we go along here. But the basic idea is to get an interplay going between the computational aspects and the logic aspects. They're basically two sides of the same coin. So sometimes we start from the logic side to drive towards the scheme block, the ML side. Sometimes I start from the ML scheme side and push them back into the logic side. It's not clear yet which is going to work better. The other thing that I wanted to get to with this audience was some motivation for talking about theory in the engineering department. Because, as again, these are working engineers, well, parts of the work at least. And therefore, they're working in a programming environment, in an industry environment, which doesn't take a whole lot of guff about theory. They program, they don't do theory, they don't prove things. So the thing I was trying to get to here was, since traditional engineering seems so well-behaved, so boring, so scientific and organized, can we not show that programming is going to go that same way, be organized? I've got a laser on me. So the software, as such, would become, software engineering particularly, would become, will be viewed as a more organized and disciplined area. So I started looking at the history of traditional engineering, the idea being that if there was a pattern that shows up now as organized in traditional engineering, perhaps the history wasn't quite as well-behaved as one would have thought looking back over the eon. So it's clear they had to go back with calculus. I did that. But I went back further because it seemed to me that you couldn't really do the calculus unless you had a decent symbolic algebra, some language to support the notions of Newton and whatever the name of Leibniz. I went back to the algebra and I found out that in fact, what I thought, being ignorant, that algebra had been around for millennia was not in fact true. There was this thing called specifically generalized arithmetic that had some characteristics of modern algebra, but symbolic algebra. But basically, it was pretty heavy going. That pre-1600s, there were basically three flavors of algebra pre-symbolic. There was a thing called rhetorical algebra, which is essentially word problems. Geometric algebra, which had a great propensity to worry about units and do rule and compass construction and crap like that. And this other thing called syncopated algebra, which was a derivative of Diophantus' work. And as you can see, there's a variation here. There's symbolic algebra. Stop doing that. Symbolic algebra on the right and a syncopated version of the same thing, so I'm told, on the left. It's clear that syncopated version doesn't do a whole lot as far as being able to do manipulations with things. And in fact, it wasn't until Vitier shows up at the end of the 16th century, he published in, it was Ars Analytica in 1516, 1991, which really changed the world, brought us the beginning of symbolic algebra. There are several layers of stuff that he did for us. The first thing, the most obvious thing, is the introduction of parameters. They were basically doing generalized arithmetic before, so they had techniques for solving specific equations, which meant that the coefficients of these equations were numbers. So you didn't have any notion of parameters per se. He brought us parameters. And that changed your whole perspective on how you deal with arithmetic, to deal with algebra. Instead of solving specific ones, you solve classes of problems. That gives you the beginnings of symbolic algebra. But besides just being able to have parameters, you have to have some way of manipulating the parameters. Since you can't resort to reduction using arithmetic techniques, you have to manipulate them as equations, as algebraic symbolic quantities. So he had the beginnings of equational reasoning showing up in this 1591 book. I did not read it in Latin, I read it in translation. And part of this also was a rudimentary theory of equations, that is, the business of being able to take these algebraic, symbolic algebraic expressions, equations, and manipulate them symbolically, and somehow out of the business of this stuff, come up with a solution to a particular variable. Think of these things as specific single variable equations, for example. I won't read this to you, but this is sort of the cogent quote from his book. He talks about the three particular, and this is sort of getting to the meta result that he gave us. The three ways of talking about the manipulation of those things, the synthetics, the heuristics, the exegetics, all boiling down to what he calls here the science of correct discovery in mathematics. So this is the meta result. He gave us the specifics. Can I go backwards? Probably not. Yeah. The specifics of the parameters in the equational reasoning and the business of being able to move around with the theory of equations. But this turns out to be, as far as I'm concerned, more important because it's specific about the general. This is the beginning of the general. I'll make these remarks available, but this is not in the paper. So anyway, here's the Vitae Trio. I've done a little bit of nudging at it because I knew where I wanted to go. But here's the basic idea. You have this informal problem. Stop playing the screen, John. You translate it into symbolic algebra. You use the heuristics to translate it equationally. This basically is the business of equational reasoning. It comes from the word, porism comes from the word heuristics, which means deduction or inference. In his initial situation, he ended up with the process of the equation of reasoning ended up with an isolated variable, which then you could get from that isolated variable, that being an answer, back to a solution of the original problem with his third portion of this trio that he put in himself, the exegetics, which, if you look in dictionaries now, it says the science of interpretation. So this is where this picture comes from, as far as I'm concerned. That should be, or can be generalized to this notion here of symbolic reasoning, blah, 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 blah. Symbolic statement, not necessarily algebraic, valid transformations, not necessarily equational, to a simplified statement, again, being reinterpreted as a solution of the original problem, which gets us to the most general thing, symbolic metaphor, which sort of underlies modern science, mathematics, because starts there at the upper left-hand corner with an informal problem based on some assumptions, transform it with the curve brackets on the upper right-hand corner to a formal specification or statement. Using valid transformations, you transfer it into a formal version of yes or no, the T or bottom. And then using exegetics, you turn it over into a solution to the original problem. So that's what he did for us at the meta level. And it's always nice to be able to associate faces with ideas and hear some faces. These guys did great things for us in terms of language innovation. Vitae over there, we know Newton has done. Frege is basically the father of predicate logic, predicate calculus. Gödel gave us some notions about the limits of what these ideas can do. And McCarthy gave us a great introduction to symbolic computation, basically getting us out of the world of things like IPL5, which I don't think many of us remember, into a reasonably civilized world that allows us to talk about symbolic computation with the same kind of flexibility and finesse that we could do previously with numeric languages. I'm going to come back to McCarthy stuff later as we go through this. So, history is part of this business. Here's some history. There's a couple more of these things that float in just for all the time. So here's some history. So we've got Vieté showing up and really changing the world. Fermat, who was not born until after Vieté died, so the influence here was basically the teacher-pupil, but not, unless you communicate with the dead, not a very lively discussion. But Fermat was heavily influenced by Vieté's view of algebra. Fermat, in turn, influenced Huygens, and in Paris, somewhere in the 1670s, Leibniz was a student of Huygens. Over in England, we have Harriot, who was an English mathematician, big surprise, who basically he's essentially the father of English algebra. So he's basically doing in England what Vieté is doing in France. He influenced Wallace, another algebraist in England, who both of whom influenced Newton. Finished this thing off. Huygens goes back to Newton in England. By the way, if you're not up on history, as I was not until I started this message, Newton published Principia in 1887. So it's just after publication. Try again. -200. Here's the mystery part. I like the history mystery ballast business. So here we go, the mystery. This is an ongoing mystery. It turns out there's this guy, Nathaniel Thorpley, who was a secretary to, he was a friend and a pupil of Harriet, who ended up being secretary to Vieté in France. Some people said that can't happen because they were in France before, but they haven't read the history. What's interesting about it is that when Vieté was a secretary to, I mean, when Nathaniel Thorpley was a secretary to Vieté, he also used an alias. I have not figured out why he did that. He didn't like French. But anyway, he was running back and forth across the English Channel, and it's not clear how much of this back and forth turned into Harriet's understanding of algebra, but there's, mysteries are good. There's also a bit of mystery about whether Descartes read Vieté before Descartes did his work. He claims not, other people say. And the other thing, this isn't really a mystery, this is something of interest, that if you look at Newton's Principia, the early going, the physics part particularly, is heavily influenced with geometric arguments. Vergniaud is a guy, my French ain't that great, deal with it. Did a lot of work in translating the geometric arguments of Newton into the algebraic arguments of Leibniz, so there was a whole bunch of stuff going on there. The other thing that I wanted to get to for the background of this stuff, as I said, was the history of engineering.
How about Euler?
He comes later, like tomorrow. I'm going to try to pick up pieces. I'm not trying to be encyclopedic about this thing. I'm trying to pick up who I think are particularly fundamentals on ideas. Okay, in the picture to the five people, I could have put Leibniz in there too. I probably could have put Euler. There's a lot of people I could put in. It's an issue about trying to hit the high spots that will make the impression. But I had room for you in there.
You should be younger.
I'm not going to shoot your time. You can shoot me when this is over. Okay, so the engineering aspects of this thing. So Mike Mahoney, professor at Princeton, has an incredible resource of information on his net. He's an incredibly generous person with his time and dealing with amateurs. One of the things that came out of one of his sites was this amazing paper by Peter Lundgren. He's in Germany. It's about 45 pages long, and it's dense. It's incredible. I mean, just look at the title. It takes 2.5 pages for the title. Engineering Education in Europe and the United States, that pretty much covers it. We've basically got 200 years of time covered here in the rise of the school culture in the engineering profession. I mean, what more can you ask for except some background or some backing up for that? That paper was incredible. Out of that paper, I got a good background of what was going on in the 18th and 19th century in terms of engineering. The disciplines at that time were basically civil mining, not mechanical yet, but civil mining and chemical engineering. Mechanical came a bit later in that 18-19 period. In terms of changing attitudes towards science, it was a very humble science and engineering. There was a very, very humble beginning. This was basically Limoges in France. That's a period of life there, big surprise. As a teenager, he discovered or invented descriptive geometry. That's something very simple in terms of what we deal with in engineering now, but at the time, the issue was national security comes up here. The issue here was building fortifications so people could lob stuff over the top and whack you. So the question was, how do you build fortifications such that you have maximum coverage of your firepower and limited access to the English, I guess. So descriptive geometry changed the ad hoc behavior of building fortifications to something that was quite disciplined. In fact, it was so disciplined and so important that the French military decided it was a national security. It should be classified. It became top secret. Even people talk about the characteristics of descriptive geometry in public until 1794, 30 years or so after he discovered this, because let's say he was a teenager at the time. But in between, he'd become a professor at a French artillery school. And he and several other very high-grade mathematicians built what was described at the time as the best science-based educational institution, bar none. I think this might have had something to say about that, but anyway, it was considered a substantially advanced view of science and engineering. Soon after France got started, Germany followed suit. Bad pun here, sorry. And I couldn't just forget this one. England had big shoes to fill. These are my clothing remarks, which is going to happen in about 20 minutes. But over in the colonies, things weren't that great. I've got these two remarks out, or these two quotes or pieces of information out of Lundgren's paper again. That even in the 1920s, the engineering establishment was still questioning the necessity of calculus. It's sort of like what we've got here in software. They're still questioning the necessity of the theory in a software program. And even as late as after World War II, 30% of the engineers in the United States had no college education at all. So it was still an extremely ad hoc situation. But by the end of World War II, the establishment, the engineering, the educational establishment changed. I started in college in the late 50s. And at that time, engineering required calculus. So things were changing, as it may have been because of the added power of technology in World War II. I don't know. But
I started in Caltech in 43. And they already required calculus for engineering freshmen.
Yeah, I'm not saying that, in fact, MIT was ahead of the general flavor of the world, but I'm saying that in terms of what the hoi polloi was doing, there were advanced places that were doing calculus way back in pre-20th century. But the general flavor of the engineering establishment in the United States was still this very ad hoc. Steve, there were certainly any exceptions to this rule, but this is simply an indication that there were a lot of Neanderthals still floating about. One of the other things I got out of this paper, this is an amazing paper. In fact, I had to go back and get another copy because I had written all over the one copy. I had to write and ask him to send me another copy so I could actually read his stuff rather than my scribbling. One of the things he also pointed out in this thing is, and this is nice to be able to give names to concepts. Monty Calvert, this book that I mentioned in here, talks about these two things. A shop culture and a school culture is a way of looking at an attitude, in this case, towards engineering and education. So we can start putting ideas in boxes. And the basic ideas here is shop culture is this practical hands-on with apprenticeship stuff, which is sort of like what goes on with software now, except we don't get apprenticeship. We simply get hands-on, you know, and you just sort of jump in and hopefully there's no sense of ethics, there's no sense of apprenticeship going on here. The school culture is what we know and love, is what's going on in engineering now. It's theoretical, it's math and science based, and the lab courses are for the practical stuff that's done in the lab courses is basically motivation for the theory. But the theory drives the school culture program in engineering, which is where we're going. So I started thinking, okay, you might be able to hang this change from shop to school on in traditional engineering on the technology of World War II. What could have changed things in the view of shop to school in traditional engineering? So I went back and thought about, okay, what's going on with engineering? The early stages were basically physical. We had this physical immediacy of measurement of moving things about and seeing if it fell down, somebody got hurt. Civil mechanical mining, to some extent, chemical engineering. Electrical is sort of a change. There's this indirect notion of measurement that happens here. You don't see electricity. You can feel it, but you don't feel it too often. But you use instruments to measure rather than direct physical immediacy. There was still some of this ad hoc stuff, and I say a lot of stuff in the paper. Edison, I didn't talk about Marconi, but Edison building stuff in as models, and then Sprague coming along and saying, look, we can do this thing better, faster, with what are called school techniques. But it seemed to me that the big change here, and again, I talk about this in the paper a lot, I front load the talk here, I front load the course, and I front load the paper with history because, again, if people understand or at least motivated to say, okay, this might be the path to go, you can follow them down, you can make them follow you down the trail. So there's a lot of motivation in all of this stuff. Telegraphy, to me, changed the thing, and I think there's a forcing event in this transatlantic cable. Namely, when you had an intact cable, you simply use ad hoc techniques to get messages transmitted from England to the United States or vice versa, because the ad hoc behavior of just cranking up the signal burns out cables, as the White House showed up. You know, wild, what a great first name. Wild. But that's his name. Wild and White House. No, he's not a wrestler either. He's a medical doctor, but he thought, as most medical doctors do, he knows everything. Lord Kelvin, also known as Thompson, or Denham Thompson, was a mathematical physicist, was of the school variety. He was able to manufacture appropriate instrumentation to make an intact cable work. He was also, I think this was the forcing event, he was also able to give techniques to discover where faults lie in a cable that's buried 2 miles over the ocean. You can't sort of go down there and look along the cable. So I think that may have been the attitude for the situation and said, okay, we can't just screw around with poker and see if it works. We need to do something that has some science and some mathematics and some predictability behind it that says, okay, this is how we can do this without having to lose people just trying to walk across the bottom of the ocean. So then the issue was, okay, can we find a forcing event or something that approximates a forcing event for software? It seemed to me, okay, there's a decent argument today about this notion of unreliability and insecurity between networks and things.
So I'm looking at that, and okay, this notion here of client-server, basically the idea that a client wants to dump a suspicious piece of software on a server in Mississippi. So that happens every day. You'd like to have the server, the receiver, would like to have some notion that the stuff that's being pumped at it has some civilized behavior. That led me over here to the notion of proof sharing code, that is this dialogue between the server who is hesitant to receive something, the client who wants to shovel stuff over. They have to have this agreement about what is the characteristic of my code, and can you actually prove that your code says does what you say it does, and if so, I would see it, otherwise take a hike. Canonical example of bad behavior is this buffer overflow thing, and I started looking at that. Buffer overflow is just it's a feature of crappy hardware and just poor software design. There is a way to get at the notion of being able to talk about this code which involves buffers and buffer manipulation array code in terms of proving properties of its characteristics. Let's get to this thing called types that I'm going to talk about a little bit later. Basically, there is hope on the way in terms of a logic which allows you to describe the behavior of array operations without having to run it. So you don't have to have runtime checks to see if you're overrunning your whatever you want to call it, your array bounds. You can prove ahead of time the code cannot do this. That's a good thing. So the overarching metaphor I went for here is this notion not just correct software, because basically the client doesn't care what the server doesn't care what the client's code is correct on, just cares if it doesn't screw it up. So the idea here is that we can deal with something that's less expansive than correctness. We can deal with predictability in the sense that the client code can do no harm. So I'm going to go with that. So you go back to the engineers. Okay, how do they predict behavior? Well, they can build a sort of cheating. You remember the Palmer Obvious code. They build something that falls down to kill somebody. You get killed. Galileo talked about building models. And even, I think, in the two sciences, early on in the two sciences, he talks about the problems of scaling up models. And Edison has the same thing. Talking about, I said symbolic engineering, or probably symbolic analysis would be better, is the winning idea. That is, you want to be able to use that essentially a Viète diagram to predict the behavior without building it, predict the behavior without even building a model. You want to predict the behavior symbolic, it's such that you can control your losses in case of errors. There's a whole other section of this paper that I didn't get a chance to get into, basically on failure analysis, because the scientific approach to engineering was not without its problems. And there's a whole issue about convincing people that just because failure happens now in software doesn't mean that failure didn't happen in this school culture view of engineering. And that's a whole other can of worms. So computational predictability here. So basic or composition, composition is if you're talking about object properties, you would like to be able to say, and this is sort of thinking engineering-wise, I guess you would call it, that you have this collection of objects which have these collection of properties, and you want to be able to know that if you take a particular operation and you combine these objects, you have some way of determining a combination of the properties. Or in a simpler case where you have one property, that the objects would predict the property, like does no harm, and you combine it with an operation, you come up with this composed object at the end here, which also does no harm. That's what I mean by compositional prediction. So you get here, so I'm just going to turn those things into rules, because I'm going for a logic-based view of the stuff, looking at things that are essentially inference rules, which is the flavor of these things. So I'm just changing operations into rules. If you go back, which I'm going to try to do here, if you go back and look at the result here, you have this function of these collected objects. There's a couple of ways you can look at that.
you can look at this function of collected objects as the result of applying the function to these objects, or you can look at it as a description of how to obtain the results. And that's what I call denotation versus sense. If you're going to look at it in this sense way, as a description of how to obtain the results, you expect something like that to happen. That is, that if this proposed object has this property, and taking the sense into the denotation, you end up with this new object, then that object should better have the property. So you expect that kind of behavior out of this reduction process. That's going to show up again later too. So then you get to this notion of logics of denotation and sense. Classical logic is what's called a denotational logic, where you basically reduce something to a value. The canonical version of the sense logic that started as this notion of intuitionistic logic in the very early part of the 20th century. Both logics have this notion of truth. Truth in the classical sense is a value. Things to be true in an intuitionistic view of things requires more than simply a value. Simply you have to have some way of demonstrating its truth. So it's not just simply that you've got a value, you have a path to its value, courtesy of something that approximates a constructive demonstration. A little history to get history is good for you. Brouwer was the purveyor of the original intuitionist view. He got to this point because of some work that Zermelo had done in terms of every set has a well ordering, but you couldn't describe a well ordering for a set problem. Kaiting and Kolmogorov are two people who work independently to try to get Brouwer's sort of ethereal mind fuzz into something approximating symbolism, symbolic language. I ran into this stuff in Stanford, I think courses from Kreisel. There were three problems with him: trying to read his writing, trying to understand what he was saying, trying to understand what he was trying to say. And the ideas were hard. But it stuck with me. I'm moving here from intuitionism to constructivity because these last two are more, in fact, Kreisel's sort of intermediate point here, working between pure intuitionism and the beginning of constructive mathematics. Curry, and we'll come back to Curry later too, and Howard and Scott were working on it. It turns out, well, Curry didn't know he was working on the constructive end, but he was. But Howard and Scott particularly were working on the notions. Dana particularly going from Kreisel, from intuition to constructive logics. A little bit of logic crap. So classical, here's some the idea here, going back to this notion of compositionality, because we're going to do, when logic is composed things up to these operations, and more implies and not be composed, but primitive parts are less complex parts and more complex parts. So here's some of the connectives that are important. It's a composition. Because you know P and Q is true just in both cases. P and Q are both true, and P implies Q is true unless P is both true, can be just as well as I can. But this is classical logic. Intuitionistic truth, or intuitionistic logic, the BHK stands for Brouwer, Heiting, Kolmogorov interpretation. Again, the idea here is it's not that we just have a value, but we have a path to a value, a descriptive way of justification. We have evidence for the value. Okay, that doesn't really evidence. So something is true. And again, true here is effectively proof. Something is true if we have a proof of each of these objects. Okay, so we have the implication is slightly more interesting. The P implies Q is true if we have a way to transform and proof and truth are the same thing here, because that we don't. If you don't have a proof, you don't have truth as far as intuition. P implies Q is true if we have a way to transform any proof of P into a proof of Q. And not P is, well, so the interesting one, the most interesting one here is the X of I left out the X. There exists an X, P of X is true. Provided we can provide this thing called a witness, a specific example of an X. and a proof that shows that that specific example of X actually satisfies P. So that, again, this whole notion of show me justification evidence going on all of this stuff. But it's still informal. So what I want to do is get from informal mind fuzz into formal mind fuzz. Constructive proof. This is where we start getting the shift over into this place. So what we want is, and this is basically where Scott was in 68. So P and Q is true, just in case we have a proof P. So P is going to be a composite object, because proof, remember, P and Q can be true only if we have a proof for P and a proof for Q. So this P, this proof P thing that we've got here is going to be a composite object, which is going to encapsulate the proofs of the parts P and Q. I used R and Twitter because I guess I'm more familiar with them and left than right. But think of it in terms of the list, because that's really where it is. So the car of P is a proof of capital P, and the putter of P is a proof of Q. That makes sense. So we've changed the and, which says proof of P and proof of Q, into a pair. And we're going to do the same thing down here at the bottom. There exists X, P of X, proof. We said there is a witness and there is a proof. Again, we have a pair. A pair consisting of the car part being the witness and the cutter part being the proof of the instance. Law is not particularly interesting here. The implication, we went from we have a way of transforming proofs into proofs, which we translate that into a specific technique named lambdas. We have a constructive function which will transform a proof into a proof. So we've got some more concrete description of what's going on here.
John, a minute before my shed.
Okay.
And there's a way of doing that, yes.
Okay, well, this is going to go real fast. Okay. That got me from constructive proof to blackboard scheme, okay? Because it's the cars, the cutters, the OR condition is basically a tag with a case expression for we're talking about it with the language. Not P is kind of interesting, because that turns into a discussion of cause to see or exception conditions as how you think about the logic of objectives in terms of the computation of a programming language. At a higher level, we get some fancy stuff here with not first order predicate values, but second order propositional, because there are just propositions such that turns into a discussion of polymorphism, abstract data types. Mitchell and Plotkin did the abstract data types. But the basic idea here is that you can take this notion of constructive proof and map it directly over into a notion of a programming language. The ML part, basically, instead of simply talking about the computational parts of the transformation from constructive proof into scheme, you can also carry over not this is provable, but this is provable and here is a proof of it. And the here is a proof of it part turns into the types, the doctor of the blackboard ML kinds of things. So you have fancy stuff. We just talked about that. That's the induction recursion or not cars. If I use cars and purpose back there, you can't read it. It gets good. Very pictures coming. To do induction as the logic, it turns into a description of recursive data types as programming language. You have, again, this dialogue between logic as propositional, circular propositional, and polymorphs of ADTs as the computational part. First order predicate calculus, this is where we get the dependent types. This is where we start talking about things like buffer overflow and its logic characteristics. Just get it more fun. There are various ways of looking at this pair of object property, basically proof versus proposition, sense versus denotation, dynamic, static. But down here at the bottom here is the one program type is the transformation into the realm of a language like ML, where you have a program and a type. The characteristic that's of importance here in a type language is a thing called subject reduction. Because one of the characteristics back here, subject predicate, was the way that Curry talked about it back in 1930. Same thing, but just different words. Subject reduction, you have a program of a particular type, and the program reduces to a value, and you know that value has a type. that's important, because if you're going to talk about predictability of programs, that is, this program can do no harm, you don't want to run the damn thing to find out whether it does harm or not. You want to say, on the basis of doing some static analysis, this program cannot do harm. You need subject reduction to be able to do that. And if this, you go back, there's a slide previous that I talked about in terms of sensitive denotation reduction. This is exactly the same picture, different names. Engineers, well, let's skip this. Deal with it. Engineers are not impressed with completeness and incompleteness results. They're in their own little world. But there are pieces of this thing of this notion of incompleteness that do nice things for engineers. Basically, numbering what the important one here is the representability theorem, because it covers two things. One is the transformation of objects of language into data, and the other is this notion of being able to prove things. Some people call Gödel a hacker. That was actually in Barwise, that's a new book that really just came out. He's actually the first computer scientist, as far as I'm concerned, because one of the things he did in his representability theorem was to take a notion which is informal. The squiggly version of the turnstile is talking about informal behavior. The girl bracketed version is talking about formal representation. If you go back to the VHL diagram, what he's saying is that his formal representation has captured appropriately the characteristics of my informal representation, such that I can deal with the formal representation, manipulate it, get an answer which can then be mapped back to say something about the informal behavior, Vietes diagram. McCarthy and Gödel, McCarthy was doing the same kind of thing, taking M expression lists, mapping it onto S expressions. Those are basically what McCarthy numbers are.
McCarthy numbers.
Well, what do you want to call them? That's what they are.
You get something out of this conference.
Oh, thanks. T-shirt's not enough. No, you don't get the T-shirt. I think there's only two left in the world that are not. Okay, final thing. Software engineering education. There's this thing in the Chronicle for Higher Education just showed up. Students once saw us computer science classes as a ticket to wealth. Now more technology jobs are outsourced, and such classes have seen the path of employment. Well, whoop-de-doo, good. As far as I have no sympathy with either the students who expect to get rich going to classes or universities who pander to that kind of thing. So I said, we want English majors. People go into English because they love the subject. They don't expect to become rich as technical writers. The English majors, the guys that are going to bring some background or some content to McCarthy School. And what we want are people who will deal with the black ballast and fewer that will pervade or accept or expect Java vocational environment. Java vocational training. And besides that, we need... Ta-da!